Good evening. My name is Shoram Teichman. I direct the Institute for Global Leadership, and we're very honored that you're here. We're very honored to have the distinguished Secretary General of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, with us this evening to think with us about her path-breaking research and thinking, which is encapsulated in her new book on the unheard truth on the relationship between poverty and human rights. The book itself is available for sale outside. The Institute is subsidizing it at $5 towards the purchase price, so we encourage you please to read this book. It's a very, very formidable piece of work. Our students are obliged to read it in EPIC, so that was wonderful. We've gotten good reviews. It's been tested by some of the troopers of Tufts. The evening is really the initiative of Amnesty International's Josh Rubenstein. We're very, very honored, Josh, to have you in our presence. For 35 years, the New England Regional Director, Northeastern Regional Director of Amnesty International, and a friend for many, many years, who enabled this to happen. The evening is part of our tradition of the Dr. Jean Mayer Global Citizenship Award. Jean was a close friend. We were a presidential program many years ago. And when he died, the first recipient was Dr. Amartya Sen. At that point, the head of the American Economic Association, the so-called conscience of a dismal science, as the New York Times called him. It's highly appropriate to be watching how the Nobel has been given out this year in economics, and to finally have the voices that I think are imperative in the context of dignity and human rights. And so it's wonderful to be able to present this award this evening to Dr. Irene Khan. Before I do that, I'm looking out in the audience. Hurst, welcome. Distinguished professor of human rights and law at the Fletcher School. Many others here who are in our lives, and most formidably, our students at Tufts. So thank you very, very much for being here. I'm also going to make special note of Gary Knight in our presence. Gary, you're sitting here as a gray, distinguished eminence. The founder of Seven, a Nieman Fellow, but in particular has won Amnesty International's Photographer of the Year Award for two times for, again, the Congo. Kosovo and the Congo, right? And we're going to be mounting a major exhibition to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Institute in January, and Gary is going to be very instrumental. Lots of weaves here, so it's a great evening for us. We have in our presence as well another distinguished Bangladeshi, in addition to Irene, and that is Dr., where are you? Hossein Zilur Rahman. Zilur is our Inspire Fellow, our Institute Scholar Practitioner in Residence for EPIC this year on South Asia. He's the head of the Power and Participation Research Center in Dhaka, a distinguished social scientist and eminent economist who is thinking of, with us as well, about the issues of poverty and human rights, development and human dignity. So we try to weave these issues together and try, most of all, to provide access to students to the research and ideas of our distinguished guests. One of the responsibilities of accepting a Jean Mayer is, as Irene has learned, to work with us and for us to work with our recipients. In that regard, most recently we have been in Santiago, Chile with Juan Guzman, a former recipient who prosecuted Pinochet with our students from Tufts and the military academies of the United States looking at constitutional issues and human rights in the aftermath of that dictatorship. We tried to do unusual things with our students, and in this context, we are very hopeful of creating research internships on public policy issues linking global warming and human rights and other sorts of aspects. So we pledge our utmost effort to you, Irene, to provide you with the finest students we can, to prepare them for you, and to try to maneuver and move the agenda forward. It's my great pleasure to invite Maya to come forward, one of our sophomores in EPIC this year, to present the Dr. Jean Mayer Award. Maya, again, is a sophomore in engineering science in our School of Engineering, and a member of the EPIC Colloquium on South Asia. Which we have subtitled Conflict, Culture, complexity, and change. Maya, if you'll come forward, tell us a bit about yourself and your research, and present the award to Dr. Khan.
Hello, everyone. So as Sherman said, I am a sophomore in the engineering school. So EPIC is a very interesting step for me in senses of actually getting to read for once during my academic career here. In terms of my research, I actually was just talking to Dr. Khan about this over dinner, and I am currently focusing on sex asymmetry in healthcare in Bangladesh, particularly in terms of infectious diseases, which, as I'm sure many of you know, tend to be very epidemic when they strike very impoverished countries such as Bangladesh. That being said, it's difficult to find factual data on, you know, how many women and how many men are admitted to certain hospitals at certain times, but it's a struggle, and I'm really, really excited about it. I plan on spending a few years really, really getting familiar with healthcare and sex asymmetry in Bangladesh in terms of particularly cholera. So, now that I've spoken a little bit about myself, I would like to talk about Dr. Khan a little bit. It is a great honor to have her here with us today. Not only is she the first woman Secretary General of Amnesty International, she is also the first Asian to hold the position. In her book, The Unheard Truth, which is being sold outside, as many of you have seen, she discusses poverty as one of the world's most catastrophic human rights crises. She describes the feminization of poverty and class-based discrimination that prevents equality of basic human rights. And she establishes poverty as a cyclic crisis that is self-propagated by human rights violations. Further renowned for her work to end violence against women and an international leader in the pursuit of human rights, we present to her the Jean Mayer Global Citizenship Award. Dr. Khan, if you would please come up. There's a plaque on this that says, "In recognition of your distinguished service on behalf of refugees and individuals at risk, prisoners of conscience, universal human rights, and your path-breaking work on the linkages between poverty and human rights." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maya. It's a particular honor, I think, to receive it from a fellow Bangladeshi woman. And to receive it from Tufts University, I know there's a ticket that comes with it, and that is engagement between Tufts, the students of EPIC, and Amnesty. But I think it will be, Amnesty's gain to have young, committed people engage on human rights issues and the challenges that the human rights community is facing in this century. Now, let me begin by telling you what happened some 48 years ago, 1961. November 1961 was the moment of Amnesty's conception. And what actually happened then, a British barrister called Peter Benenson was riding on the train in London on the what you call the metro, and he saw a newspaper story about some students, young students in Portugal, who had raised their glass to liberty, and for that reason, they were sent to prison. And that shocked him so much that a few months later, in another newspaper in the UK, the Sunday Observer, he published this story about prisoners of conscience. He called on all freedom-loving people to protest and to write for the release of five prisoners of conscience that he had selected then. That was Amnesty's birth. Now, the interesting thing I'm going to talk to you about today is Amnesty's journey. Now, those five prisoners of conscience, all five of them were men, four of them were white men, and all five of them had university degrees. Earlier today, I was speaking to a group of Amnesty supporters, and I told them about one of our recent cases, prisoner of conscience. And she is a Mexican woman, an indigenous woman, a street vendor, who was thrown into prison in Mexico because she protested the arbitrary application of laws by the local municipality about street vending. And to me, in a way, that describes Amnesty's journey over the last almost five decades from working for the rights of one type of people to working for the rights of others. This indigenous woman, when I was in Mexico, she was in prison in 2007, the last time I visited Mexico, I tried to see her. And the authorities would not allow me access to her. You would have thought as though she was a high-powered dissident that they were trying to keep Amnesty away from. I met with her husband. He works as a shoeshine man, shining shoes in the street, and expressed my solidarity. Amnesty picked up her case. We campaigned for her release, and eventually she was released after 18 months. So I think in that description of what happened in November 1961 and what has happened more recently, I think you can see the long journey that Amnesty has made, speaking up for the forgotten prisoner, working for the forgotten prisoner, but the forgotten prisoner has changed over time. And what I'm going to talk to you about is the forgotten prisoners of today, and they are not all to be found behind prison bars. That's Amnesty's challenge, and they're not all to be adopted. Many of them are to be empowered. And so from adoption to agency is a journey that Amnesty International has made, the human rights movement is making, and that may be the path towards, I think, greater relevance of human rights in our world today. Now, I was at the EPIC class today, and some of you will have heard me speak of some of these things, but please bear with me. You know, when I'm speaking to the same audience in different places, some of the issues will be same, but there will be a different slant, and you're free to ask different questions. Don't ask me the same questions again. I began the class today, and in the class also I mentioned a story that is there in my book, very early in the first chapter of the book, the story of Rosie. Now, in early September 2001, just after I was appointed to my position as Secretary General of Amnesty, I was in South Africa, and for the World Conference Against Racism at that time, and I was invited by the Amnesty researcher to accompany her to see how Amnesty carried out research. I went with her to a local police station, and there we were looking at complaints, you know, what resources do people have to make complaints, and I discovered that there was a counselor in the police station, and the counselor had been put by the South African government, by the government of the Natal province, to provide support to women victims of domestic violence so that they could submit their cases, they could get the support they needed. South Africa has a very progressive law on domestic violence, which allows a woman to get a protection order with very little fuss from the local magistrate. Now, when I started talking to the counselor, she told me the story of Rosie. She said Rosie was battered by her husband and beaten so badly that she died. So I asked the counselor, what happened? What went wrong? Why didn't Rosie apply for a protection order? And the counselor said to me that Rosie did not have the bus fare. She could not pay the bus fare from her home to the magistrate's court. So this fantastic law that exists in South Africa was of no use to Rosie. Now that showed to me and to all of us here, I think, the link between poverty and Rosie's security. Income was an important element here, but so was the insecurity. And that's why, I know there are a few economists in the audience, I think, but that's why I would contend that poverty is much more than about low income. I think low income is a very important element of poverty, but it's much, much more than that. If you are poor, you're deprived of the basic necessities of a dignified life. If you are ill, you cannot afford medical care. If you have children, you cannot afford to send them to school. If you're hungry, you may have to go without a meal. So you are deprived of your right to health, education, food, water, a decent livelihood. And under international human rights laws, these are rights. These are not needs. These are clearly not issues to be met through the market, but they are rights. But poverty is more than the deprivation that I just mentioned. Poverty is about powerlessness. If you are poor, you do not control your life. If you fall ill or if you lose your job, you don't know what will happen next. So there's insecurity, there's uncertainty. If you live in a slum, you're likely to be at the mercy of criminal gangs or slumlords. If you live in a village and you are landless, you may be at the mercy of your landlord. There is no state to protect you, no police to come to your aid. In fact, very often, the state and the state authorities, the police, are seen as predators by the poor, as oppressors rather than protectors. And you have no say, very often, you have no say in the decisions that affect your life. Your government could build a dam and drown your village. An oil company could dig a pipeline through your land and displace you. Your landlord could evict you with no notice. And because you cannot read or write, you don't know how to petition your member of parliament, if there is one, or approach your municipality. If you try to organize with your community, then you are very likely to be beaten up and thrown into prison. And you can't afford lawyers. The judges belong to an elite that doesn't understand you and don't have a sympathy with your cause. Your government doesn't care about you. They don't give you the information they need. They don't listen to you. They may or may not arrange a situation where political parties will cart you to the polling station once every few years and help you cast your vote. And they might pay you a small amount for that, but that's about as far as your relationship with political leaders go. The police see you as a threat, sometimes as a criminal, simply because you are poor, because you're living in neighborhoods where crime is rife. You are stigmatized along with others in that neighborhood. You cannot afford to pay the bribes that the petty officials demand, and so very often you can't register your marriage, you can't get access, or the birth of your child, you can't get access to hospitals, you can't even register the piece of land that you may own. And a lot of poor people do not have identity papers. They do not have birth certificates, marriage certificates, land registration papers, and live in an environment of illegality. And what I'm telling you, that is what the poor say. And a lot of that data you can glean if you look at the Voices of the Poor, a document prepared by the World Bank in which 60,000 poor people were interviewed. So that data is available to the World Bank, and you may well ask what they do with that data. Now, the poor, what they are telling you, if you listen to them, is that they have no security, they have no voice, they're excluded, they're marginalized. They're deprived of basic necessities, and they tell you they face discrimination. Now, they don't use the language of human rights. When I have been in places like Darfur, like Kibera, the slum in Nairobi, or most recently to Sierra Leone, or even in places in Bangladesh, they don't talk about human rights because, of course, they don't know the language. But what they do talk about is discrimination, justice, their demand for equality. Because behind their story lies all that, inequality, discrimination, injustice. The vast majority of the poor, about 70%, are women. And that proportion is actually growing. And that's what is sometimes called the feminization of poverty. In 113 countries of the world, girls don't have equal access to schools. Over 500,000 women die every year in childbirth or pregnancy-related reasons. Now, some of you will know the Millennium Development Goals, which is actually an agenda for poverty eradication set up by the United Nations. It has 8 goals. And progress is being made on all the goals, to a greater or lesser extent, except the goal to reduce maternal mortality. Now, maternal mortality is related to health issues, women's access to health, but it's also a human rights issue because it's about the status of women. Who decides when a woman should marry? Who decides when she should get pregnant? Who decides how many children she should have and how she should space them? Who decides even whether she should go to the health center or not? Who decides when she should eat, when a pregnant woman eats? And we are back to issues here of inequality and injustice. And most importantly enough, who decides how much of the national budget should be spent on maternal health care as opposed to, say, defense. Now, women's voices are not heard. And I would say that the failure to make a dent on maternal mortality is one of the clearest examples of the discrimination, the insecurity, the inequality, the exclusion in which poor people live. I was in Sierra Leone 3 weeks ago, where 1 in 8 women die of maternal maternity-related reasons, pregnancy or post-pregnancy or during childbirth. And many of them literally bleed to death. And the discrimination is so perverse that it comes from all sides. Women in rural areas of Sierra Leone are considered as minors, so they don't have the authority to make decisions. In the health system, there is corruption, there is bribery, high costs, although the government has announced that medical care for pregnant women and children is free, it isn't in effect. Families have to pay. And when families have to pay, the question is what value do they put on the lives of their women? And many do not value women's lives. So what I found most striking was how maternal death was considered inevitable rather than preventable. Women told me stories of how when they got pregnant, all their family members from different parts of the country came to see them because they were saying goodbye. And one woman said, you know, pregnancy is like a death sentence. When you get pregnant, you know, it's like receiving a death sentence because your chances of survival are so low. Now, that's one example of the discrimination inequality that underlies the poverty. Now, another recent example that I saw was in Kibera, which is the largest slum in Africa, 1 million people in the heart of Nairobi. And in Kibera, the conditions are terrible. The living conditions are terrible. The land belongs to the state, yet people have come in, built shacks, which they rent at exorbitant rates to other people, to poor people who are living there, who have no security of tenure, no rights as tenants. They basically don't exist. They simply stay in those huts. And I met, for example, a woman who had gone into hospital because she's suffering from HIV/AIDS to get treatment. When she came back, she had been evicted. And there are slum clearance programs where, of course, forced eviction is part of the story. You bring in police, you clear the land because developers are interested in the land. Basic services are not available. Through Kibera, you see water pipes running through Kibera to supply clean water to the rich neighborhoods, but the people who live in the slums themselves have no access to that clean water. They have to pay 30 times the cost of water compared to what others are paying in that area, and even then, water is very scarce. So, and, you know, inequality persists even in the richest countries of the world. In the United States, there is a document called Measuring America, which was produced a few years ago, where there was a study of human development indicators in the U.S., and the highest educated, longest living persons in the U.S. are actually Asian males, and the lowest are Latino females, and the difference in terms of life expectancy is, I think, about 14 years. Education is similarly, you know, if you look at the percentages of college graduates and so on, very, very dramatic. And that's why, as human rights activists, we always need to ask, yes, there is growth, there is progress, but who is being left behind? Who is marginalized? Who is outside that circle of prosperity? And economic analysis actually doesn't necessarily give you that picture of powerlessness. And even I think many economists do agree with that. In fact, economic growth, while essential to pulling people out of poverty, also increases inequality. In all of the developed countries in recent years, as we've seen economic growth take place, we've also seen developed and developing countries, we've actually seen inequality grow. And in China, income disparity is about 30-1. And in countries with impressive growth rates, you don't necessarily see improved living standards across the board. Now, in Bangladesh, we've seen impressive growth between 1990 and 2006. But in that same time period, child malnutrition worsened among girls. Access to clean water fell in urban areas because of the growth of slum population. And neonatal mortality actually is higher now in urban areas of Bangladesh than ever before. So if you take a growth-based approach, then the poorest are the last to benefit from the boom and the first to suffer in a bust. And economic investment itself cannot set that straight. You can invest. You can invest in agriculture, and the farmer can increase crop yields, but whether or not he gets secure land tenure depends on something else. You can build schools, but whether or not girls get access to the schools on an equal basis as boys, whether they get to school and stay in school, you need to do other things. And this is where human rights comes in, because the issues that I'm talking about of discrimination, insecurity, inequality, exclusion, marginalization, deprivation, these are human rights problems. And that is why there has to be a human rights agenda to address poverty as well as an economic agenda. And people, the lived experience of the people, actually shows that to us very clearly. And when we're talking about a human rights agenda, the other point I want to make is that it is not one particular right or even one set of rights. It's the holistic approach to rights that will make a difference. And by the holistic approach to rights, I mean pursuing economic, social, and cultural rights as well as civil and political rights at the same time. Now, why do I say that? You know, when I was in Eastern Congo, in Goma, meeting women's groups a few years ago and talking to them about what they wanted, many of these women, most of them actually, were rape survivors. And they demanded justice, but they also wanted health care. So for them, both the right to health care as well as the right to justice was equally important. I was in Chile last October, where I met the Mapuche Indians there, and they came to complain to me about the loss of their land. But at the same time, they were also talking about violence and insecurity and how could they be protected from insecurity. So if you take a people perspective on human rights, which is what Amnesty always does, Amnesty did not fight for the right of for the right not to be arbitrarily detained. It actually fought for the release of prisoners of conscience. It's focused on the individual. If you focus on the individual, then you have, by nature, to look at the whole gamut of violations that people suffer. How do they get justice? How do they enjoy freedom? That becomes then your objective. Now, there have been barriers, however, to this approach to human rights. And Amnesty has been part of creating some of those barriers, although we are now trying to overcome what we had done in the past and learn from what has happened. Now, the first issue, of course, is very often economic and social rights are not recognized as real rights. There are those who say, well, it's difficult because while you can identify who tortures you, it's very difficult to identify who's responsible when you don't have health care. So the connection between this perpetrator and the harm is not clear enough, and therefore it becomes difficult to enforce these rights. They also say, well, economic and social rights cost money. To build health systems, to build school systems cost money. You can't expect poor countries to treat these as rights because they would not be able to live up to their duties. And they say, well, after all, economic and social rights require a lot of policy choices to be made. What you spend on, how you spend it on, these are policy choices, and courts are not the right place to make those decisions. Yet, if you look at each of those issues, you know, there is another side to it. Economic and social rights place positive duties and negative duties. So does civil and political rights. And it is possible. It is possible, and it has been done in many countries, in constitutions of many countries. Economic and social rights are reflected as rights, and courts have enforced them. India and South Africa are two good examples where that has happened. And when it comes to money, actually building a good justice system, ensuring fair trial, putting in place a good police system costs a lot of money. Fair trial doesn't come cheap. So to say that economic and social rights cost money and civil and political rights don't isn't correct. A lot of people will also argue that economic and social rights are political. I know that when we've had this debate inside Amnesty, or we've had debates with people about whether or not Amnesty should take up these issues, one thing that I frequently heard is, you're getting into a political area. This will politicize the organization. Now, I come from a humanitarian background. I worked with refugees for 21 years before coming to Amnesty. When I heard that first, in 2001, I was taken aback, because as a humanitarian, political prisoners are a highly political issue. And Amnesty was never afraid to go to a government and say release that person because you're wrongly detaining him or her, regardless of who that person was. And that wasn't political, but if you say girls should go to school, that becomes political. So I think this notion of what is political and what is not political also needs to be attacked. And it's very important because the World Bank, for example, will not address some human rights issues because they see them as being political. And so they will ask countries to make structural adjustments on their economic policies. But when it comes to addressing discrimination issues with girls or minorities, that becomes political. So, you know, there is an issue here, I think, to be taken up. Now, the other problem with application of human rights in the area of economic development is the feeling that if you promote development, then you may have to suppress some rights in order to achieve development. And that would be what I would call the Chinese argument. It's not dissimilar to those who say, if you have to have good security, then you have to erode or reduce some civil and political rights. We've heard that argument before, as well as you know, in the context of the war on terror. Now, you don't have to sacrifice rights in order to gain prosperity or security, is what I would argue. China is held up as an example, but there is no empirical evidence to suggest what economic advantage has China gained by suppressing civil and political rights. It's not clear if you look at China's economic model. What was actual gain made by suppressing civil and political rights? On the contrary, what we see in China is disparities, growing disparities in income and social unrest. And we've seen that in the last year when workers have been laid off, there's been rural unrest. And there is also a long history of disastrous outcomes in China. The Great Famine, the failure of China to pick up the issue of HIV/AIDS in a timely manner. We've had the disaster of schools, poorly constructed school that collapsed. We've had the melamine disaster where melamine was found in milk powder. And all those issues have been very difficult for the Chinese government to grapple with because it's a closed society. If you complain, if you criticize, you first get locked up and beaten up. And then there is a big scandal, it becomes international, and then the Chinese turn around, arrest a few officials, line them up, and execute them. And that is no way in which to make progress. And we see that time and time again mistakes being made, and in autocratic systems, it's very hard to pick up those mistakes and correct them when they do happen. And in any case, there are few Chinas and many more Zimbabwes and Burmas and North Koreas and Sudans and Congos and Chad and all these countries which are rich in resource but poor in people's well-being. There is, of course, on the other side, the argument that open markets will eventually lead to open societies. And that doesn't necessarily happen either. Now, of course, both the socialist divide and the capitalist approaches have all disappeared in a market economy. Even China is a market economy. But markets themselves do not always meet the needs, particularly of the most vulnerable, the most marginalized. So the responsibility for ensuring human rights rests with the state. You can privatize, but if you privatize, even within the system of privatization, you have to make sure that basic rights are protected. There are arguments about what is, you know, the right to health. Someone was asking me today earlier about the right to water. How many liters of water are you entitled to? You know, those are debates. There are guidelines. There are discussions going on in those areas. But that it is a right needs to be acknowledged, because a right is an empowering process. A right places a concurrent duty. A right, therefore, creates a system for accountability. A right provides a remedy. And those are the advantages that a human rights approach brings to development. Now, why should Amnesty be worried about this issue? I think because these are human rights problems. But Amnesty should also be worried about these issues because of the urgency of the problem, the sheer numbers. A third of the world's people live in poverty, and that means they're excluded, marginalized, forgotten, sidelined, insecure. It doesn't mean that amnesty will solve the problems of all these people. It doesn't mean that amnesty becomes a poverty eradication organization. What it does mean that at the sharp end of the wedge, where the worst, the most egregious harm is taking place, and that harm impoverishes people, keeps them poor, traps them from enjoying their human rights. The human rights abuses are so egregious, amnesty cannot remain silent. Otherwise, we will have no credibility. The other issue, of course, is things will get worse. Things will get worse, certainly. We have seen with the financial crisis of people have been pushed back into poverty. I was struck this morning with, I think, on the front page of USA Today, the number of people who were receiving food stamps a year ago and number of people who are receiving food stamps today. The spike in that is actually an indication of poverty here in the world's richest country. And clearly, if you look down at other countries, you see the same worse situations taking place. Some people say that between the food crisis and the financial crisis, about 100 million people have been pushed back into poverty, wiping away the gains of the past decade. And in any case, the poor cannot wait. If the urgency of this problem, if we ignore it today, then I think we will have failed to address those human rights problems that affect most people in the most dramatic way. I think we would miss, I think, our mission as Amnesty if we forget those forgotten prisoners. Now, what can human rights do for poverty eradication? We've analyzed the problem, but the issue here is not to point fingers. The issue is actually to argue that human rights can make a difference to poverty eradication strategies. Now, what can we actually do? I think first, we can impress the issue of participation. Participation leads to better development than repression. And that, again, if you look at World Bank's research, it actually shows that there is a correlation between good governance, respect for human rights, and good development outcomes. And what that means is those living in poverty must have a greater say in their own lives. And this is about freedom of association, assembly, expression, people's access to information. These are very powerful rights when it comes to tackling poverty. Empowerment. These are empowerment rights. The right to criticize, the right to dissent, the right to disagree is very important. It's as important as the right to health, water, and sanitation. And empowering people, therefore, means both sets of rights, you know, promoting freedom of expression alongside freedom of education, right to education. And there are very good examples of progress that has been made when participation has been respected. And I don't mean participation in a technical sense of the word. That very often happens, that you have a project and you consult with the local community, you tick off the box, okay, that's participation done. What I'm actually talking about is also systemic change. That means broader participation of people, allowing freedom in the country to discuss issues, to debate issues, to participate in the political life, to change things. And that's where the human rights agenda comes in. The second thing I think that human rights can do is tackle inequality and discrimination. Inequality breeds injustice, and injustice leads to conflict. Inequality also leads to all kinds of imbalance. Take the feminization of poverty, for example. Now, we cannot believe in the universality of human rights on the one hand and accept that a third of the world's population lives in slums. We cannot believe that human rights are universal and then not be outraged that 140 million children in the world are underweight because they don't have enough to eat. We can't believe in the equality of all human beings and accept that 75% of the world's poor are women. So there is a huge discrimination inequality agenda that the human rights community needs to tackle. And thirdly, very much as part of the human rights approach, we must hold those in power accountable. Donor governments and international financial institutions promise much, but don't always deliver. Developing countries blame others, but impoverish and oppress their own people. Big business takes no responsibility for the human rights impact of its own performance. If you look at some of Africa's richest countries, and I say they're rich because they're rich in natural resources, countries like Chad, countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Guinea, Angola, very rich in natural resources. International companies operate there. There is a collusion between the government and the company, and you know, the people miss out on that. So poverty, I'm arguing, is not about economics alone. It is about human rights violations and eradication of poverty. There may be different strategies. I'm not proposing any particular strategy. What I'm basically saying is, no matter what strategy you pursue, if you do not include in that strategy the human rights element, then you will not get the development outcomes that you are looking for. So the basic message is, empower those who need reform most and let them claim it from those who rule in their name. And that's much more than ballot box democracy. That's actually looking at empowerment, the tools of empowerment. Law is an important tool. Law does not always work for the poor. Very often, actually, law works against the poor. And as lawyers, I'm a lawyer, as lawyers, we need to recognize that and set justice straight. But there is non-legal empowerment as well that is very important. And there are many, many good examples. One of the things I have deliberately done in my book is to talk about the good examples, the success stories. Because if we are going to convince policymakers, we need not only to point to the problem, but to show that where certain conditions have been met, results have come about. So in conclusion, what I want to say is that human rights, to me, human rights are the breakthrough strategy for development. It's about accepting human rights holistically. It's about applying human rights in the most egregious situations of harm. In Amnesty's case, we've decided to focus on maternal mortality and on slums as the two key areas. Maternal mortality because of the terrible situation there, how closely related it is to status of women. Slums because it's very much related to the 21st century, the growth of urbanization, and the challenges that we will face in terms of climate change and the environment. And we are also doing a couple of other interesting things, and I will just mention that quickly before I end. One is we are promoting what we are calling a G2 project, G2 being the US and China. And we will campaign to have the United States adopt the UN Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and we will campaign to have China adopt the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, because we feel that as global leaders, there must be a shared vision on human rights, and that vision must be a holistic vision of human rights. And I think for the United States to adopt economic and social rights as rights will make a major difference in the way in which the US then dialogues with the rest of the world, the way in which other parts of the world look at human rights and accountability, and it will also change the debate here in the United States as well, away from an ideological approach to economic and social rights, which were seen as the domain of socialism, and civil and political rights as the domain of capitalism. It's going to break those barriers and see universal human rights as universal values. That's our G2 project. The other project on which we are engaging is the Millennium Development Goals. That's basically the anti-poverty, the poverty reduction strategy of the international community. That's where donors are pouring money. Yet progress is actually uneven. And in fact, progress sometimes, or lack of progress, is not visible because reports aggregate data. Disaggregation, even something as simple as disaggregation of data, will show you where discrimination is taking place, who's being left behind. Is it urban population versus rural population? In Bangladesh, for instance, it's the urban population that is doing worse on neonatal mortality, and that's because of the growth of slums. In other parts of the world, if you take China, it's the rural population that misses out on many of these development indicators. Women would be another factor. Among women, let's look at low-caste women. Let's look at migrant women. Let's look at women living in slums and so on. So again, if you disaggregate data, you make visible the problem. But the Millennium Development Goals also have to recognize participation as a major process of development, not as a technical issue, but as inherent in the idea of development. And this, I may sound a lot like Amartya Sen, but then after all, he's also a Bengali compatriot. But I do think that through his work, he has shown that that's what development is, freedom, and freedom is part of development. So Amnesty International, for Amnesty International, this is a big challenge for the kind of work we are doing. But I began by talking about forgotten prisoners. And today's forgotten prisoners are women who bleed to death because their family doesn't care or cannot afford to take them into hospital because they're not given the power to make the decisions about their own life. Forgotten prisoners are children who are dying in slums for lack of clean water, sanitation. The forgotten prisoner are those who are disempowered, who are marginalized today. Let me end with the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, and some of you will have heard this, when she said, "Where do universal human rights begin? In small places close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere." And let me conclude with one little place, one small place that Eleanor Roosevelt was talking about. And this is a village in the north of Bangladesh, in Tangail. Small place. I visited there in January of 2008 when I was in Bangladesh with an Amnesty delegation. And we went to visit a BRAC project. BRAC is an NGO that operates in Bangladesh and internationally. It's a Bangladeshi-based NGO. And they were running a legal literacy project. And when we went there, we saw this group of village women sitting in bamboo mats in the middle of the little courtyard. And the teacher, they couldn't read, most of these women could not read and write. They had received microcredit from BRAC. The teacher was teaching them about the legal age for marriage in Bangladesh, about underage marriages. And she was using posters and graphics to get her message across to them. And so I asked the women, you know, what they were borrowing the money for, and someone said they wanted to buy a sewing machine and open a small tailoring business. Another woman was going to buy goats and sell the milk, and someone else was going to have chickens and sell eggs and so on. And then I said to one, I asked one woman, "Well, why are you in this class? What do you hope to get out of it?" And then she said, "I want to know more about my rights, because I don't want my daughters to suffer the way I have suffered. I need to learn how to protect my rights and theirs." Now that, to me, was a very, very powerful message coming from this woman who couldn't read and write, but who had the means, who'd been given resources. She wanted empowerment, she wanted also to know about her rights, and she wanted to stand up and protect her rights. And so I've felt very clearly at that moment the claim to human rights and human dignity. What does that actually mean? And that's why I believe that today's prisoner of poverty has as much claim on Amnesty International as the prisoner of conscience. And, you know, we stood by the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina. We stood with the dissidents of Soviet Union. And today, what we did then, I hope we will have the courage to do today, to stand with the forgotten prisoners of today and to empower them, to help them in their struggle for justice and freedom. I think that's what human rights is about. Thank you.
Questions, folks? Will you please hit the mics? We're recording this. We'd like to publish this. If you can come to the microphones and identify yourself.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessing to the whole room and the distinguished speaker. My question is a question of philosophy, something we can all gain from, and that's finding our own personal purpose. So I ask, how do you ask the eternal question of philosophy, the three questions: who am I, who is my creator, and what is my purpose? How do you ask those questions, answer those questions personally, and maybe we all be helped in answering them for ourselves?
Well, wa alaikum assalam, peace be on you too. Now, who am I? That's an interesting question, because over dinner we had a rather interested, animated conversation about identity. And identity, as Bengalis, as Bangladeshis, there were three of us there, Zillur Rahman, Shafiqul Islam, and myself. And we each had our own view of our identity. And my identity, I think, is multiple identity. I'm many things. I'm a woman, I'm an Asian, I'm from Bangladesh. I'm a lawyer, I like theater, I like making jam. Now, you can take whichever identity you want from there. And I think the question here, when we talk about who am I think we need to figure out where we interact with other people, where, you know, what is common between me and someone else, because there are commonalities and differences, and too often in our question of identity, we focus on differences rather than commonalities. Who is my creator? I think that is a question that each one of us have our own way of defining according to the faith we have. And why am I here? I think, again, each of us have to find our own answer to that question. But I think increasingly in an interdependent world, we will have to identify what we are here for in relation to how we live with others. I think climate change and environmental questions are making that very, very clear to us. It's not just a question of working for my own welfare, because my welfare is very closely tied up with yours. And it goes to the heart of Amnesty's philosophy. Amnesty's philosophy has been those who have rights should stand up and use those rights to defend those whose rights are at risk. And that global, that sense of global solidarity, I think Amnesty globalized that concept many decades ago. But I think today, in many different ways, that same challenge is being put to all of us.
Good evening. My name is Tanya Henderson. I'm an LLM student here at Fletcher. My question is regarding, I really thank you so much for your work on gender law and poverty. It's actually what I'm studying here. And what I've been struggling or trying to find peace with is between international human rights law on gender and discrimination and how that plays out at, within customary law that is often the governing law of most of the areas where gender issues really need to be addressed.
Well, you know, I think international human rights, one of the most important evolutions in international human rights law in the last few decades has been in the area of women's human rights and breaking down the barrier between the public sphere and the private sphere. And it's thanks to women's movement, not thanks to human rights movement. They came late to the debate. It was actually the women's groups who started challenging, saying, why is the state ready to protect a woman who's beaten up by a policeman, but the state is not as interested in protecting a woman who's beaten up by her husband in her own home? The woman has the same rights whether she's at home or in the streets. And, you know, that's a reality. In Switzerland, I looked at statistics there, and I discovered that the police respond faster and more often to calls when a woman calls from the street if she feels threatened. But when it's a domestic situation, they don't. They are much slower in responding, and that's in Switzerland. So you can imagine in other countries how that happens. So human rights law has come late to it, but human rights law has come to it and has created the concept of due diligence, which means that even where the state is not responsible for an action, it has to take care to create an environment where others private actors do not violate rights. And that means ensuring that women will have access to justice, women will be able to escape from violence. There's an obligation to ensure that when gender violence is concerned. Now, I think human rights, the principles of human rights, which are universal values now, if you look at the key human rights instruments, all countries in the world have ratified one or more of those instruments. So this notion of human rights don't apply to certain countries is no longer true. And there, human rights provide universal values against which you measure custom, culture, religion. And so custom, culture, religion cannot be used as an excuse to deny equal rights to women as to men. Men have the right to be free from violence, and so do women. And you challenge them on that basis. Because the real barriers to gender violence, are inequality, impunity, and apathy. And apathy is actually the hardest one to fight. Even among ourselves, if we know of a woman who suffered violence, for example, at the hands of her partner, many of us would say, why does she stay with him? How often do we say, why is he doing that? How can we stop him? How can we punish him for it? So I think that apathy exists, and that's why gender violence exists. So it's a question of state, policy, laws, but it's also a question of social attitudes and standing up against that.
Hi, Dr. Khan. I'm Alistair Chang. I'm a sophomore undergraduate student. I really like the idea of thinking of poverty as a human rights issue rather than an economic issue, but I can't help but think of what Paul Krugman argues as when he talks about sweatshops, and he says, you know, the only thing that is bad about sweatshops is that there aren't enough, and that if you consider their alternatives instead of working in the sweatshops, that the sweatshops are significantly better. And in order to address that, I have always thought that, you know, educating the people is the best solution. But I'm caught in this paradox, I guess, where I think that, I guess what I'm asking is, how then can you educate the people to consider education as something that's important to them and not work in the sweatshops as something that brings, I guess, momentary relief, momentary monetary gain, without thinking about, I guess, something that could bring them improvement in the future?
Well, education, of course, is a very empowering instrument. And education is important for a whole range of reasons, from personal development to improving your livelihood. But when it comes to sweatshops, I can understand, I don't necessarily agree, but I can understand why some people would say in some countries working in these factories under terrible conditions is better than the alternative, which may be domestic work, which also exposes women and girls to lots of harm, and that harm never even comes to light. The answer really for sweatshops is not only educating people, it's about our consumer habits. Why do we want to buy things so cheap that someone else's sweat has to be the price for it? So how we change our habits, what responsibility do we take as individuals to fight for human rights? I think, you know, when you see individual responsibility, look at the issue of the environment. There is a lot more happening there, whether we turn our taps off when we are brushing our teeth, and I know lots of school children are taught about the environment through little actions like that, or whether we bike to work rather than drive our car, whether we take public transport. Through many, you know, we are changing our habits. They may not mean much in the global, in the global arena, but as attitudes, they actually help us to understand the threat to climate change. Now, how many of us think about our responsibility for human rights in that way? For what happens in other countries? What responsibility do we take for them? Many of us, Amnesty members, for example, write letters. They complain. They ask governments to change their behavior. But we need also to think about our own behavior. To what extent does our own behavior feed human rights? And for Amnesty, I think the big challenge and the opportunity came with our campaign to stop violence against women. Now, that campaign was launched in 2004. In 2003, I led a process inside Amnesty together with others about changing Amnesty. We introduced, for example, gender policies against gender harassment, gender discrimination. We looked at gender representation, women's representation in decision-making positions. We began to question ourselves as an organization, because what gender violence did was suddenly the perpetrator wasn't out there, the victim wasn't out there. Sometimes it was in here. And so, you know, taking responsibility for human rights may change some of those issues that you're talking about, like sweatshops or child labor.
Hi, hello, good evening. My name is Kelsey Stein, and I'm a first-year MALD student at the Fletcher School. And my question is, tonight you've clearly outlined your kind of definition of human rights as being intrinsically inclusive of social and economic rights as kind of a new paradigm for the human rights field. But what I'm wondering is whether you think it's programmatically and analytically useful to conflate human rights with human security, rather than thinking them as two different but interrelated concepts. And then also, if so, what distinguishes the work of Amnesty from organizations like CARE and Oxfam?
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't think human rights and human security should be conflated. I think for human rights, there is a legal regime, There are clear duties, responsibilities, rights, accountabilities that have been set out, and we would lose that if we were simply to talk about human security, which is an attractive political term, but which doesn't have any legal value. Human rights are underpinned by a system of international law. Human rights are underpinned by international treaties. Human rights are underpinned by constitutional rights, by national laws, and national legal systems. So let's not forget that. Now, is amnesty like Oxfam or CARE? Well, I don't think Oxfam or CARE stand up and talk about empowerment of people. They talk about freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of association issues. They're not necessarily even talking about water or health or housing as rights. They provide them, they deliver them. They are trying to look at what is called rights-based approach, but very often there is a project-based approach to participation, and that's why I said earlier that what you're talking about is participation in a broader condition. There's no point, or there's very little point, I think, in trying to develop a project in, say, a country like Egypt, where you develop a project and you talk about participation and you tick off participation because you've spoken to the local beneficiaries. But it's a country where you have no freedom of expression. You publish something in the newspaper, you can get locked up. You can get punished. How can there be true participation in a system, in an oppressive system? And very few development organizations are able or willing to raise those issues, because if they do that, they get themselves into a position, in a confrontational position with governments, they get thrown out, they have the humanitarian programs, they have their beneficiaries to whom they have to deliver services, and for them it's very important to deliver water, health, sanitation programs, and they are very important. And therefore, I wouldn't want Oxfam to become Amnesty or Amnesty to become Oxfam. I think these are complementary approaches, and I think that's where the value added comes of a human rights organization entering this arena, where promoting the rights of the people, promoting greater accountability, promoting greater transparency becomes key issues of development.
Hi, Dr. Khan. We were talking a little bit earlier about the example of Syria, where the Syrian government doesn't allow big international NGOs like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch to do their work, and therefore a lot of the human rights reporting and advocacy falls to the diplomatic community, which can politicize discourses around human rights in ways that could ignore some of the more nuanced perspectives on human rights that you were talking about tonight. So how can Amnesty International and other NGOs work in countries where they're not allowed? My name is Duncan Pickard, I'm a senior.
Actually, I think technology has helped us enormously there. I think we can now communicate, we can now talk to people, we can share information with people in a way in which we couldn't in the past, thanks to internet, thanks to other types of information technology. So that's been great. There are restrictions, there are difficulties, there are even dangers, risks to which people put themselves to. But we recently, a few months ago, we opened an online communities project by which we now have 85,000 people who access that on a regular basis. Many of them live in Iran. And we get demands for our documents to be translated in Farsi, not only about Iran. These people are hungry for information. They want to know about human rights situations in other countries, and so they're asking us, you know, can we have reports on other countries? We don't have access to Iran. I think it's a similar situation with Syria. I think what there is something else, though, in your question there, and that is about politicization of the debate of human rights. We recently did a survey, an independent opinion poll, a polling organization did that for us, about the attitude towards human rights in the Middle East. It was done in five different cities in the Middle East. And what we found was interesting. When you ask people what they thought about torture or fair trials, they were against torture, they were in favor of fair trials. So all those answers were correct, what I would call correct answers. They were in support of human rights. But then when you said to them, what do you think about human rights? Their response was, well, that's U.S. foreign policy. So human rights were seen as U.S. foreign policy. Amnesty International, surprisingly, this was a few years ago, they thought we were close to President Bush. But it actually shows the challenge of communications. I think I have Gary there who can probably explain to me how that happened. But, you know, so the ideas and the concepts, yes, we agreed with them on that, But why? Because the term, you know, human rights and democracy, freedom and democracy, you remember, were concepts that were so often used in foreign, and are so often used in foreign policy discourse, that they are seen to be part of foreign policy. They're not applied across by these same governments equally in a balanced way across the board. So people don't see them as universal values, they see them as foreign policy issues to be pushed. And that is very damaging for human rights.
I'm Renata Capella. I am a LLM student as well. I'm very pleased to see you here tonight. I remember reading 2 years ago the reports of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Professor Paul Hunt at the time, and he was highlighting the issue of maternal mortality and actually calling on international human rights organizations to take up the issue. It seems that Amnesty read his reports as well. I was wondering, by opening up the scope of your work and including economic and social rights, how has that changed the organization in terms of membership, perceptions in the developing countries, and also in terms of campaigning techniques? Can you campaign in the same way on civil and political rights and economic and social rights? Thank you.
Well, I think expanding our mission to look at economic and social rights made it possible for us to tackle something like violence against women. Because as I said earlier, rape survivors in Darfur or in Eastern Congo were demanding health care as well as justice. And we were able to respond on both issues. So it allowed us to work to better outcomes for people whose rights are at risk. In terms of our own research, there are new challenges. Amnesty's research methodology is very anecdotal. And that's a very powerful communications tool when you put the stories of individuals out there. That's the way we've done it. If you look at most of our reports, you will see a lot of individual cases which we use in an emblematic way. Now, when you come to economic and social rights, you have a lot of empirical data. So we have to learn to deal with empirical data. We have to learn to communicate those data as compellingly as we communicate individual stories. Maybe we need to use individual stories, and we certainly will need to use individual stories still. So in terms of our research, we are looking at much more participatory approaches to try to, historically with political and civil rights, we've identified the problem and we said, well, that's a problem, fix it, basically, to the government, that's it. But when we are coming to all these other issues, we are more and more being asked by governments, yeah, we agree with you, that's the problem, but tell us what can be done. That's the interesting change that has happened. There are more and more governments today that are buying into the idea of human rights. So it's no longer a question of selling that idea to them. It's actually a question of dialoguing with them as to what are the right solutions. And that means our recommendations need to be refined. That means we need to listen more to the people who are affected to figure out, you know, what kinds of solutions would actually work in those situations for them. Now, in terms of our campaigning methodology, sometimes our traditional methods are still effective. We recently did, it's a couple of years old, urgent action in Brazil, where we were defending an indigenous leader who had been thrown into prison and who, in fact, I think he was killed later by the authorities for protesting forced eviction of his people from land. And so we picked up his case in the traditional way as a prisoner of conscience, but at the same time, we also looked at the whole community, and we made the whole community part of our urgent action scheme. And we got people to write in and campaign with the government and so on, and we were able to stop that forced eviction taking place. So we used a traditional method, but that doesn't always work. We do have to look at different ways of campaigning. We are exploring different ways. In Sierra Leone recently, we did what we called a caravan. We actually brought in activists from Africa, other parts of Africa, from Europe and elsewhere, to travel throughout the country in a caravan, trying to raise awareness about women's rights, women's health rights, and those kinds of issues. So there was a large part of human rights education tools and methodologies that we were using there, rather than simply a question of, you know, policy advocacy with the government. So there will be new tools. New tools are being developed. New ways of working are being developed there in research and campaigning. It's a learning process for us, and I'm sure Josh would tell you that in the US, for example, as we look into the issue of economic and social rights, it's also training our membership to understand what these rights mean, why they're rights, How can they campaign? How can they be effective? The empowerment approach is a different approach for Amnesty from an adoption approach. So that is also a learning process for us. But it's a very enriching experience. I think we are building new partnerships, getting to meet people that we would not meet before, we have not met before, getting to learn from people and also sharing what we have learned with them, building capacity. Amnesty has national chapters in the Global South, but those chapters are few and weak. And we are building our national chapters there, which means we're building human rights communities in those countries, building civil society in those countries, so that they speak up for rights there. They work with other partners. They put pressure on their governments, just as you would put pressure on your government here.
Assalamu alaikum once again. I wanted to ask you a symbolic question. As you stand in front of the logo of Amnesty International, which is a logo seeming to me to be a candle behind barbed wire, not a human being behind barbed wire. So this symbolically would mean, as we speak about human rights, we also are speaking about the human spirit that wants the human rights to lead a dignified life. So that flame on that candle, for it not to be blown out like many lives and spirits are blown out by the deplorable conditions all over the world. I'm sure you've been brought to tears many times from all that you've seen. I know you're not doing a sob story here. You're doing a very empirical scholarly work to share with us. But in order for us to be in America where these is not as obvious, you actually have an international global spirit to care about international issues such as poverty. So my question is, in America, they blow out a candle, you know, for your birthday, and that is the making of a wish. So I would like you to say, if you could answer of all of your work, what would you wish for in all that you've seen?
Okay. Well, let me first say the story behind the candle for Amnesty is the old Chinese saying, it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. So it's better to do something about things than sit and complain about the problem. That's how the candle came about. What wish would I make? I think the wish that I would make is that people anywhere would consider, people everywhere would consider human rights abuses anywhere to be a concern to them. I think that notion of international solidarity, reaching across borders, I think I saw that thinking beyond borders, thinking beyond boundaries, acting across borders, I think that is what human rights are about. You know, when we talk about globalization, we look at the downside of economic globalization very often, or we look at the profit motive in economic globalization. We forget that human rights are global values. They've globalized ethics across borders and boundaries. And I would hope that all of us would empathize with others. You talked about the US, empathize with those who do not have the rights that you enjoy, and stand up and speak out for them. The world looks to the United States for leadership. You have a president who can provide that leadership now. So support him, push him, encourage him, prod him to provide that leadership to the world.
Hi, I'm Julia Evans, and I'm a freshman in the EPIC Colloquium this year. And I just have a question in terms of your emphasis on individual empowerment and whether or not you think that outlets for artistic expression would be a means to alleviate the perpetuating sense of apathy that you just referenced, and also the question of identity, cultural identity within impoverished communities. Like, could you elaborate on how maybe you could, you know, advocate for artistic expressions or implement artistic outlets?
Irene, would you like to hear the questions?
Yes.
Dr. Khan, thank you for being here. My name is Hannah. I was a student at Tufts, and I work at the IGL. I think your book really emphasizes the link between power and poverty as well. So I was wondering if you could speak to how the human rights framework can be used to bring about change in the behavior of elites in countries and the people who have power.
Thank you. My name is James Reynolds. I'm a guest here, and also I was the BBC's China correspondent for the last 3 years. My question's about China. China's argument, of course, lifting 400 million people out of poverty is a human rights achievement. How might your broadening of the definition of human rights change your relationship with China? Thanks.
Good. Let me start with China. I think that's a very good point. We have been working on human rights issues in China relating to the criminal justice system, for example, the whole issue of fair trials, the issue of death penalty, the treatment of human rights activists, freedom of expression issues, internet repression, minority situation of the Uyghurs, for example. Last year, we published a report about migrant workers in China. And we looked at urban people coming to urban areas who didn't have residence permits and the kinds of restrictions they had. We put pressure on China during the Beijing Olympics, and we gained something out of it. We got the restrictions on our website lifted there. And we do see a shift in the Chinese discourse, a very slight one, very nuanced. Would seem to us, but from the Chinese perspective, it's a very big shift for them. They actually have produced a human rights action plan in which they don't rule out the possibility of acceding, for example, to the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They don't rule it out, so it's there. And the other big shift on China, of course, has been on Darfur, where eventually China came around along with others. So I think China's engagement with the world, the Chinese presence of Chinese business and economic interests in Africa and other places, those will begin to have an impact on China. I think China, the challenge is to show China human rights not just as issues of ideology and principle, but as a pragmatic approach to governance. So if you look at Africa, when Western companies, I mean, there was a Western oil company operating in South Sudan that eventually pulled out, we put pressure on them from human rights perspective, but they also pulled out because they realized in the long term the insecurity and human rights abuses that were taking place was not good for their profit. It was not good. It was just costing them too much, so they pulled out. Now China and Chinese companies are moving into those same situations of human rights abuses and violations and so on. They will very soon recognize that good governance actually makes a good business, provide stability and security that business needs. So I think all these various factors, looking at economic and social rights alongside civil and political rights, engagement with the world, looking at corporate engagement in parts of the world where China was not engaged before, all those are opening up possibilities in China. I think the current, change is small, but I'm fairly optimistic about engagement with China in the long term. Now, the next question was about power and poverty. Well, human rights are about regulating power. Human rights are about regulating the power of the state against the powerlessness of the citizen. It's about regulating the power of those who have resources against those who don't have it, protecting minorities, others, groups, and so on. So the whole system of rights holders and duty bearers create an accountability framework. And that's why looking at economic and social issues as rights, those that are recognized in international law as rights, I'm not saying every single economic or social issue, the key ones of health, education, housing, and so on, it's very important because it does create that accountability framework. It's not just something that you can leave to happen, either as philanthropy or as a market. So I think that's the whole idea, in fact, of human rights is about regulating power, creating some constraints on those who hold power, putting some benchmarks for measuring decision-making according to certain values that the international community has accepted. The last question was about cultural identity and artistic aspirations. The poor have as many aspirations as we do. And you will find sometimes, we may as people who have various resources get irritated with poor people when if they get a little money. I've seen that in my own country, in Bangladesh. They earn a little bit of money and then they just go out and splash it on something. And you think, why are they wasting it? You know, they need so many things. Why do they go buy flowers when they really need food? But, you know, they want to express their spirit. They want to raise their spirit in the same way as you and I do. And this is why I want to end with what I saw yesterday in Boston. I went to Rosie's place, and some of you may know Rosie's place. And what was really uplifting there was the dignity with which they treated the homeless women. How when women came in, they showed us the place where food is served. And what they did there was they actually served the women. They did not let them queue up and stop the food into dishes. They were giving them the dignity of being served as in a restaurant, because that was so important for the people. You know, valuing, being valued was so important, and dignity is so important. So I think there is a cultural spirit there. And I know a lot of people will say, well, if you're poor, then you're very interested in, you know, food and basic things, and you don't really care about art and culture. But actually, poor people do. They sing and they dance. They spend money at weddings, which is a waste of money in many ways if you look at it from an economic point, but it matters to them to enjoy that moment. You will see very simple art in the poorest countries of the world, utilitarian art, paintings on clay pots, for example, or the way in which they organize, in my own country, they will mark designs. They'll make designs on mud floors in the huts, because those are all ways in which they're expressing their spirit and dignity as a human being. And to my mind, actually, human rights are a means to an end, and the end is human dignity.